benefits from such as this, and I only regret that I can't stay longer. Pass the afternoon.
Yeah, well, thank you, Bob. Might I just return to Charles Wilkinson for a moment? David Case outlined the multitude of local government authorities that native people in the villages must contend with, but there's another side to that coin. In some villages, they've been able to use all of these emanations of governmental authority to assist them in the local scene and to obtain access to resources perhaps that might not otherwise have been available. And I got a whiff of that in the Menominee thing, because you said that in the end they wound up with their IRA restored, their IRA government, their native government. It holds their land, and that means it is immune from taxation. But you said that the county, which is a state government, the county government's boundaries are coterminous with those of the Indian lands, and so the county government has remained and is a vehicle for providing state funds. Is that really what happened?
Yes. The county government, though, is smaller and less important than the tribal government. There are just more powers that a tribal government has within Indian country than a county government. So the county government is just smaller. There are some state programs, though, that do go to the county. In an ideal situation, I would think this would be ideal, it might be that the state could amend its laws to provide that some of those funds could go directly to a tribal organization rather than a county. I'm not sure there are benefits from the two, substantial benefits from the two separate organizations. I suppose that would need to be thought through.
What about non-native people living on the Menominee land? They can participate in the county government. They
cannot participate
in the tribal government.
They can, and you mentioned your unitary court system. They of course, many of their matters would go to state court. So there are some functions of county governments. One may be voting under Alaska law. They may have functions such as voting. There may be some non-Indian land in there that, or non-native land where taxes could be collected. So there definitely are functions that remain. I don't mean to suggest that, but it does seem to me wise to explore the possibility of some state funds going to the tribal organizations.
Tom?
David Case and then Sheldon.
I just have a couple of questions about the relationship of the county and the tribe, and maybe the origins of it. Was that something that the Menominee desired in the first place as part of the restoration to retain the county, or was that a matter that was negotiated?
Well, there just has to be a county government in Wisconsin, because there just are county functions in there. So you could not, it seems to me, do away with the county government. So it wasn't so much that the Menominees desired it, although I guess they did, but it was that it was accepted that it was necessary and that there were functions that continued.
And it's still accepted that it's necessary, is that?
Yes.
And
yes.
The county and tribal government, are they separate? The peoples that are on the governing councils are separate, different people, or
yeah,
they overlap,
they,
or what?
They are more separate, I think, than many of your than is the case in many of your villages. Generally, they are different people on the county board as opposed to the tribal legislature.
Are there any jurisdictional conflicts between county laws and tribal laws and the like?
Yes, although it tends to be state laws more than county laws in the case of the Menominees, because
PL3.
Since the boundaries are the same, it is mostly Menominees in the county government, so you don't have the conflicts. On many reservations, most reservations, the county lines are not coterminous, so the county, boundaries which extend off the reservation include large numbers of non-Indians, and so there is a potential for conflict there that it just happens don't exist at Menominee. I don't know of another reservation in the country where the county lines are the same as the reservation, so that's unique and certainly atypical. It may be unique and is atypical.
Sheldon, catch a tag.
First of all, Judge Bridger, I'd like to apologize for being a little late, but I was doing a little research that I had to catch up on. One of the things that has been mentioned is the fact that tribal governments are racist institutions, and I think I must repeat often as I can, that tribal governments are not racist. And the IRA Act that recognizes tribal government, formalizes tribal government, recognizes that. We are political institutions recognized by the federal government to do those things for our membership, our constituency, our tribal members, for their common good. The Constitution, boilerplate people call it, for IRA Constitution and bylaws. I have a copy of the Native Village of Unalakleet's Constitution. Under membership, section one, section five, membership rules. The village may make rules to govern membership either for the purpose of carrying out this article or covering membership matters not taken care of in this article. Traditionally, village people have accepted or rejected participation in the village life of our society on the basis of are you or are you not a contributing, viable, constructive addition to our tribe. And as a result, I think there are a number of non-natives that are even members of tribal councils. One that comes to mind immediately is Bill Miller, who happens to be president of the IRA council or the traditional council of Dot Lake. But there is an understanding there. There is still only one chief in that particular village. And his obligation is to oversee the functioning of that council, to provide for the common good of the tribal members, even if it means abiding by a non-native president. If he is, at the present time, that person best qualified who has been approved by the membership of the village to be a member of the village, and if he has the expertise necessary to carry out the will of the chief and his council, then it is their obligation to provide better government for their people that they must utilize him until such time as one of their own can assume those responsibilities. If that is the wish of their people. Federal Indian law, one of the bases of it says that statutes passed for benefit of dependent Indian tribes and communities are to be liberally construed for the benefit or in favor of Indians. And for all intents and purposes, the natives of Alaska are Indians. And I would like to state at this time that the tribal governments, the rightful governments of our people, which predate not only the state of Alaska, but also the United States of America by thousands of years, are legitimate governments. We trusted the federal government with certain things, lands protection, education and educational services, health and medical services. We didn't entrust these particular rights and protections of our government to the federal government forever. And we didn't entrust them to the federal government to be diminished in any way. Our understanding of this trust relationship as tribal governments is that, if anything, our rights, our powers as tribal governments are to be maintained unchanged. And if possible, the federal government has an obligation, by whatever means available to them, to improve not only the effectiveness, but also the authority and rights of that tribal government. There are a number of other things that I think we as tribal governments have a right and a responsibility to our membership to seek. When we see that legislation that has passed regarding our people is seen by the government of our people to be detrimental not only to our people, as ANCSA is, but it is also very detrimental to the tribal governments of our people. ANCSA specifically states it is not a jurisdictional act, but by the very exclusion of tribal governments and their functions as that most powerful protector of not only our lands, our tribal lands, but also that most sacred institution of our people, our tribal government. We have an obligation to stand up and say, that is enough. And we can demand, we have a right to, full restoration to the peace, dignity, and sovereignty which we enjoyed not only prior to the Statehood Act, but prior to the Treaty of Sessions. Thank you.
Thank you, Sheldon. Well, Spud, do you want to?
I also have a little trouble with the title of this Roundtable Commission. I think a more appropriate title to this would be The Alternative, Native Governments with Its Land. Because I think there's something very viable that's being missed that really we're not looking at as thoughtfully and as fully as we should. Sheldon mentioned the ages of Native governments. There is something very valuable in something that has lasted thousands of years, that is older than even most European countries. We must have gone through those infantile stages that most of the European governments are still trying to struggle with. If you really look at what Native government is all about, it's nothing more than an extension of the family, the very basics of any government system. And if you really sit down and look at your own government in your own household, you don't stack the house with books on the relationship between you and your wife. You don't stack your house with ordinances and agreements between you and your children. You don't stack libraries full of garbage with the relationships between you and your other relatives. Your mother, your father, your grandparents, your in-laws, and some outlaws. You don't have that garbage. And I think we are losing something very basic when we started dealing with paper and pencil. We're getting entangled like a fly on flypaper, and every time you stick out and go a different direction, you get stuck harder. I think we have to look at the value of Native governments, why they lasted so long, and why we're fighting so hard to retain them. Something that can last that long has some very real values. And I think it's in the best interest of all governments, if you want to look at this internationally, to find out why they lasted so long. What made them function? What made them work? It's basically a government by consensus, which is the same that you do in your own household. The government by consensus. And I think the technology today in the world is getting to the point where we can now use that on a much broader basis. Before, you used to have to put everything on paper because the information had to be passed in that form in the Western types of governments. You didn't trust each other, so you had to put it on paper so you go back and refer to it later. There was no real mutual trust, and there still isn't. And that's part of the problem that we're seeing with our negotiations of retaining our own governments today. So when you're considering these types of discussions, also consider the value of something so old that nobody can really remember where it's coming from, something that is just an extension of ourselves and our families, and see if that can be passed to you instead of you trying to think that you're taking something away from us.
Thank you, Spud. Well, I think that that's been a good morning's discussion, and if Tony, we'll give you the last word before we adjourn then.
Thank you.
Tony Vasca.
Thank you, Commissioner Berger. What I wanted to do was, for the record, identify what the function of the Governor's Task Force on Federal State Tribal Relations is doing here. What we're doing in the next, well, we've been doing all fall, is collecting public testimony to give to the governor to make a recommendation to the state legislature. And there are four legislators on the task force plus seven other members from the general public representing the state, the governor's office, and a variety of other organizations and individuals. We're gathering public information, and we've been traveling throughout the state holding public forums, and we have one more public forum before we meet next week in Anchorage to analyze some of the public information that we've gathered. Our purpose here today was, once we looked at your agenda and saw who was going to be discussing the different facets of tribal governing bodies or tribal governments, we thought it was well for us to come and listen to other experiences in other states or countries. And most of us who are sitting here from the task force will probably apply what we hear today and probably gather more information from not only the commission, but other individuals in the next couple of days.
Thank you, Tony. By the way, if members of the task force are returning this afternoon, and I hope they do, and have any questions that they would like to throw out to some of these folks who are here from the Lower 48 and other places about state-tribal relations, please feel free, through Tony or Mr. Hope, you or any of the others, because we're quite informal here. Well, let's break now till 2 o'clock. Oh, sorry, I forgot about this.
Yeah. I think that sometime I think it's more important to go through the stuff we've been doing.
Yeah.
Sometime.
Yeah. is a... Well, the first thing I want to mention is that for the folks in the audience, the governor's task force is meeting tomorrow at the Egan Convention Center in room number 6. That will be a public hearing by the governor's task force, and you're all welcome to go over there. And Jennifer Fate pointed out it's just a block away, and so you would be able to take in both the round table and the governor's task force hearing. So I hope you will feel that perfectly free to go over to the governor's task force hearings. They're tomorrow, December 13th, at the Egan Convention Center, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Jennifer assures me there will be some very interesting testimony from some groups recently featured in the newspapers, who take a somewhat different view of sovereignty, I gather, than has been expressed here. We'll just carry on with the discussion of the matters that came up this morning. We heard from Ralph Johnson, and he told us about the history in the United States and other countries of IRAs and native governments generally. And then David Case presented a proposal that he wanted us to discuss for village home rule. And then we had a discussion generally of state-tribal relations. And this afternoon, I was going to call first on of all on Reed Chambers. And before I do that, I want to welcome Willie Kasayali and Sam George from Akiyachuk, who've joined us since we adjourned at noon. And maybe we could talk a little bit, Reed. I mentioned that you and I think Larry Ashenbrenner would be able to tell us about the Maine settlement in 1980 and how it dealt with the question of state-tribal relations, taxation of land, and so on and so forth.
Well, thank you very much, Tom. I represent the, I guess, one of the three tribes in Maine. It's the Houlton Band of Maliseet Indians. The Native American Rights Fund, which Larry is counsel for here in Anchorage, represented the other two tribes in Maine. Now, in describing the Maine settlement, my client came into the settlement rather late. They showed up in my office in the summer of 1979, and I frankly had never heard of a third tribe in Maine at that time. I learned about them subsequently, but they came in and said, look, we have an Aboriginal land claim in Maine too. And I said, well, you do? I said, how could you have this has been on the Walter Cronkite news show for the last 7 years, and you're coming in now when there's about to be a bill before Congress and putting together an Aboriginal claim in Maine. And they said, well, yeah, we always had a deal with the Passamaquoddies that they would cut us into their claim. And they're not doing it now, and we've got to get this put forward. It turned out they had a quite viable Aboriginal land claim to about 1 million acres in that part of Maine that looks like a camel's hump. It's called Aroostook County, there was once a war fought, or almost a war, so a war of words fought between Daniel Webster and a British foreign secretary named Ashburton about Aroostook County, whether it was going to be part of the United States or whether it was part of Canada. Fortunately, we don't have those kinds of controversies between our two countries anymore, Tom, but that was in the 1830s. And I guess Daniel Webster won. But what it really was then was Indian country. The Maliseet Indians in 1838 clearly had a subsistence lifestyle in that area, very much like Alaska Native groups do today. There's even a town in that part of Maine called Caribou, Maine, and that at that time they did have caribou in Maine at that period. They don't any longer. In any event, when I got into the Settlement Act negotiations dealing with the two tribes and with the state of Maine, the deal had pretty much been cut. So when I describe this deal, I can't really tell you that it's a deal that I crafted in any way. In fact, to some extent, I was unhappy with it, still am. But I can describe basically, I mean, ultimately, we came in late enough so that we were ultimately included in the deal, but we had to pretty much take the cards as they'd been dealt at that time.
Why don't you describe the deal to us, criticize it, and then Larry can defend it if he's of a mind.
All right, let's do that. Well, essentially the arrangement was that the one thing that the state of Maine would not give on at all was having the concept of a separate political structure in the state that was going to be separate from the state government. That the state of Maine had been exercising, or thought they'd been legitimately exercising, jurisdiction over the Maine Indian tribes for ever since there'd been a state of Maine, 1820, so that they were simply unwilling to negotiate very much about that. So we had to take that. Now, they were willing, however, to support the concept of ultimately $81 million in payment for the three main tribes and about 300,000 acres of land to be purchased for the tribes. the way that it was structured was that the other two tribes, but not the Houlton Band of Maliseets, would become home rule municipalities within the state of Maine. And that the state would have the general state laws would apply to them, including the laws dealing with municipal government. That there were a couple of areas that the other two tribes they had small reservations, the other tribes. The state was not willing to agree at that time to a reservation for the Houlton Band of Maliseets, my client. And that's still something, actually, we're still in negotiations now with the state about in terms of acquiring land for the Maliseets. But that need not detain us here. Essentially, the structure is that the Passamaquoddy and Penobscot tribes do function as home rule municipalities within the state. They have a court system that is like the court. Now, in Maine, there are municipal courts, so they have the tribal court system really is a municipal-type court system. They do have some latitude about hunting and fishing laws. That was one thing they were able to negotiate about. But otherwise, I suppose that if the state of Maine was to change its laws dealing with home rule municipalities, it would affect the Indian tribes to the same extent that it would affect the other municipalities in Maine. One of the results of that, for example, has been that Maine Indian tribes cannot play bingo on their reservations, that other tribes in the lower 48, including some of my clients, have found it very lucrative to set up bingo games on the reservation and to some extent to be immune from the state laws setting limits on the amount of prizes you can have for bingo games and the hours you can play. And some tribes do have very lucrative bingo operations. The Maine Supreme Court held, I think correctly so, given the Maine Settlement Act, that the Penobscot tribe, one of the two tribes that's a home rule municipality, simply had to comply with the state laws dealing with bingo, and that the Maine Indian Settlement Act had abolished any special immunities that the Penobscot tribe would have had from state jurisdiction there. Now, I happen to believe that it's very important for Indian groups to have as much immunity as they can from state jurisdiction. I mean, I and some others around this table have spent a good part of their career fighting notions like Public Law 280 and trying to get it construed perhaps more narrowly than Congress really intended it to be construed. and we've generally been successful in that. But I think it's important, Tom, I think it's important for the same reason that the land preservation is important. Because Indian groups in the lower 48, and certainly native villages here, do live a separate cultural and political existence. They just do. And to have the state be able to essentially impose its laws on those communities does make it much more difficult for the native communities to have a separate culture and a separate polity. I think that state jurisdiction is something that I've always resisted where I can for my clients. And I guess if I'd had the chance, if I'd gotten into the Maine settlement negotiations earlier, I would have tried to resist it there. I don't know if I could have succeeded. It was one thing that the state of Maine seemed absolutely insistent on. And it was important to get the Maine settlement legislation passed in 1980 for various reasons. I think correctly, those of us representing the Maine Indian tribes did foresee that it would be more difficult to get that kind of legislation through with a Reagan administration, which did seem probable then, than with the Carter administration, which we had. And there were other reasons to rush it through as quickly as we could. So I don't know that I would have been successful, but I think that the other two main tribes did have the feeling that being exempt from state jurisdiction was not as important to them. That they'd been, after all, they had been subject to it, and actually so of the native groups here in Alaska. It was something the state was unwilling to give on in any event. So that when I'm being critical of it, I don't know that the soup would have taken the pepper I would have tried to put in it in terms of trying to get a different kind of arrangement than the one that was crafted between NARF and the state. I don't know that I could have effectuated that, but it is something. I don't necessarily endorse this concept of a home rule municipality. I think it's an interesting concept that David's put forth in the paper this morning. I think it may be a necessary compromise with the state government, because I do think if you look at all of the settlement legislation that has been passed dealing with Indians by Congress in recent years, certainly none of it overrides any state. If the state takes the position they want jurisdiction over the Indian country, none of the legislation overrides that. You've either got to do what Charles Wilkinson did, which is persuade the state of Wisconsin or whatever state it is that it doesn't really need this kind of jurisdiction, or you've got to accommodate it some way. And the Maine Settlement Act does represent an accommodation to state jurisdiction. The Narragansett Act does that, the Western Pequot Act. I mean, all of the eastern land claims that have settled on the notion of the state having broad jurisdiction over the Indian area. The Gayhead Wampanoag settlement that's going to Congress, went to Congress late last year, and will go again to the new Congress. All of these do have the feature of state jurisdiction. I mean, I have a feeling that that's something that's going to be pretty hard to beat in Congress right now. I think that with all of the, I mean, unfortunately, the what Ralph Johnson was saying this morning is very correct, that the kind of political consensus that the rest of the country reaches at a given point of time tends to govern what Indian legislation is going to be. Whether you've got a liberal government or a conservative government, it doesn't much matter. The kind of political consensus that the rest of the United States is reaching now is a political consensus in favor of decentralization, federalism, state government governing the things closest to it, and things like that. And I think that's a pretty hard tide to swim up against. So in that sense, I think that the Maine Land Claim Settlement Act represents a useful model. And it's too early to say how it's working out, really. I mean, you can't sit there and say that because the Indians can't play bingo, it's a failure. I mean, bingo is, after all, something of a windfall, maybe viewed as something of a windfall for the groups that are able to profit by it, notwithstanding the place that we're meeting in today. But I find it a nuisance. I mean, it does mean that things like you do have hassles, for example, in representing the Maliseets. I find I have hassles now with the Maine Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, that the Maliseets end up discharging an employee, and the employee complains that he or she is being discharged because she's not an Indian or something like that. Well, that's just the kind of thing you don't have to put up with in any other state. If you get some hassle from the North Dakota Equal Employment Opportunities Commission, you politely write them a letter and say you don't have any jurisdiction here, bug off. I mean, you don't have to mess with a commission hearing, and you don't have to go educating a state commission about Indian preference laws and that this is really a federal contract we're implementing and the federal regulations allow Indian preference. And, you know, all of that is costly, all of that's time consuming, and you're always much better off if you can just write the letter and say you don't have any jurisdiction and we're not gonna have to do further business with you. So there's certainly that. I can't really say that I've run into situations as general counsel for the Maliseets that have really impinged on their self-governing authority yet. I think the jury's still out on it. And I think it is probably on the other tribes too. But it is different than representing, say, a Sioux tribe in North or South Dakota or Montana.
It said that under the settlement they received $81 million and money was made available to buy 300,000 acres of land.
Yeah, some of that was from the $81 million. It's not, there was a land purchase fund, and then there was a separate fund for the tribes that was set up.
What is the status of the land? Who owns the land? If you went to the land registry office and said, who owns this land, whose name would be on the title?
It depends on where the land is, Tom, that for the Holton Band of Maliseets, when we ultimately purchase land, the United States will own it in trust for the Maliseets. That's also true of the traditional reservation lands for the Passamaquoddies and Penobscots. The other land, though, the 300,000 acres less the 5,000 that's going to be acquired for the Maliseets, 295,000 acres for the other two tribes, is going to be acquired in what's called a restricted fee status. That means that the tribes will own it, but they cannot sell it. They can lease it, they can make timber sales on it. There was the same feeling that, again, and Larry may be able to speak to this better than I would be able to. I certainly had a sense that the attorneys for the Passamaquoddies and Penobscots in Maine had the same feeling that some of the leaders of the Alaska Native groups had in the late 60s and early 70s, that they didn't want federal supervision of what they could do with their land. Now, I think that's an open question, whether you're better off with federal supervision or without it. I tend to be more cautious about this. I tend to think that getting federal approval for land transactions is a basically healthy thing in the long run for Indian tribes, but it does subject you to a bureaucratic review of your actions that tribes can reasonably resist, it's a question of, I think in the long run, if you have federal supervision of it, you may have to be more conservative about your use of the land, but you're more likely to have it after a while. Now, as I say, the Passamaquoddy and Penobscot land is restricted against alienation, so it can't be sold. But they don't have to get some of the same approvals from the federal government that other tribes do in the lower 48.
So the two larger tribes always had reservations, and they then acquired between them 295,000 additional acreage that is held in restricted deed.
That is correct.
But it's not part of a reserve.
It's not part of a reservation. And indeed, as to those lands, Tom, they tend to be out in the forest. They're not around the subsistence. I mean, the Indians live in Indian colonies or reservations, essentially, which are like other reservations. Those had been state supervised reservations until this land claim was brought, and now they're federally supervised as a result of the land claim settlement. The other land is investment land, forest timberland out in the unpopulated areas of the state. As to those lands, they have to comply completely with state law, say when they market the timber and harvest it and so on. So
is that land liable to state taxation?
Yes, it is. They make payments in lieu of state taxes. They've set up a system where they make payments. They're not liable to the exact tax, but they're required to make payments that are the same as the tax in lieu of taxation, and the state is able to invade the settlement funds to get that money if the tribe should not pay it. Now the taxes are pretty low. I mean, you're dealing with unorganized territory in the state of Maine. It's rather like the unorganized borough here in Alaska. Or analogous to that. That it's funny, if you go up to Maine, as I did the first time I went up to see the Maliseets, I looked on the map and you fly into Bangor, which is a fairly large city for Maine, 50, 60,000, 40,000, something like that. And then you see on the map there's an interstate highway going up to Houlton, where my client lived. I got on that highway, and once I got out of the suburbs of Bangor, I didn't see anything. There was no, I mean, it was as undeveloped as the most undeveloped parts of the West that would have a highway going through them, say the Bitterroot Valley or something like that. And you started going through areas that were called Township 2 North, Range 5 East. I mean, it just didn't even have any name. And every once in a while, you'd come across a gas station. Now, I've never driven on the Alcan Highway, so I can't say what it's like. But it really is. There are large areas of Maine that are simply unorganized territory in the northern and western part of the state. So there isn't substantial taxation going on there, but there is a state timber yield tax of some sort, and they do have to pay equivalent payments for that.
Well, just one other question. You said they were making payments in lieu of taxation.
That's what it's called under the statute.
And is that a federal statute?
That's right. That's the main. Well, let me back up. I guess I need to tell you maybe more than you want to hear, a little more than this. That the way that once an agreement was reached between the tribes and the state of Maine, it was embodied in a state statute. I don't know why they did it this way, frankly. I mean, it wouldn't have, again, been the way I would have preferred to do it, but I didn't have any choice on it. So that the agreement between the tribes was first embodied in a state statute, and then some draft federal legislation was taken to Congress and proposed to Congress and enacted with some changes, but now I believe the payments in lieu of taxes are in the state statute, aren't they, Larry? Do you know? I mean, I think when you're, I guess I would, you know, I wasn't. I think there's a provision in the state statute that talks about payments in lieu of taxes in the same amount. Probably the federal statute ratifies the state statute, which again is a funny sort of thing, because then you don't really know whether the state statute is a creature of federal law or state law. But it's I don't think the payment in lieu of taxes provision is in the federal statute, except to the extent it ratifies the state statute.
David, you had a question?
Just a couple of small points. Are the tribes themselves deemed to be home rule municipalities, or are there two separate institutions, a tribal government and a home rule government?
I think it's just a single entity. Now, again, I don't represent either of those tribes, David, so
And the Maliseets aren't in that position.
No, the Maliseets, I was able to get, I mean, rightly or wrongly, I got the Maliseets out of that particular provision. In other words, whether it's an advantage or a disadvantage to be a federally recognized Indian tribe without being a home rule municipality, the Maliseets are simply a federally recognized Indian tribe.
Do the Maliseets have any difficulty getting state funding, or any more than the Penobscots and the Passamaquoddy?
I don't
have?
Think they get any state funding. I was just thinking of that when Charles was answering the question for the Menominees. I I mean, I could be wrong, but I think I would know about it if they did get state funding. I don't think they get any direct state funding. They do have very substantial, I mean, for a small tribe, they're about a 400, 500 person tribe, enrolled membership. They do get pretty substantial federal grants and contracts under Public Law 638 and Johnson O'Malley and so on.
Are there any powers or authorities that the tribes have, you know, either as tribes or home rule municipalities, that go beyond the powers and authorities of the normal main home rule municipality? You mentioned fish and game authority. Was that something
yes.
that is exceptional?
They do, and again, David, I would have to look at the I would have to look at it, and we could do that. I mean, I can supply you with that. There's not any mystery. It just wasn't something that I was particularly concerned about in terms of representing my client. I didn't want it, and we didn't have it. And I think they do have some powers. They certainly have taxation powers on their reservations, but I think that's just the normal powers of a home rule municipality. But I think in terms of fish and game laws, they do have some fish and game powers that a normal home rule municipality would not have.
So there may have been some negotiations beyond the home rule powers for super home rule powers.
For special
powers.
And they would have been provided as a matter of state statute. I mean, in other words, that when the agreement was made, it was put into a state statute. And the state, to that extent, did differentiate between these two tribes and other main home rule municipalities. So it's certainly possible to do that. And again, it may be an inviting thing to do. I think that in terms of making any kind of settlement here, I think you do have to bring the state along with you. Now, in Maine, there was a substantial club over the state. There was litigation that threatened the title to land to two-thirds of the state that would be brought if there couldn't be a settlement. So there was a very substantial inducement to the state to settle. I don't know that the advent of 1991 puts the same club on the state, or whether Indian Country kind of jurisdictional litigation here, the potential for that puts the same kind of club on the state that Maine had a very substantial club at its gun at its head to come up with some kind of a deal there.
But nonetheless, there was some negotiation of
substantial
jurisdictional parameters for these two governments, let's say, or the three.
That's right.
Whatever.
And that was really before I got into it. But there was a lot of negotiation, and again, the attorneys for the other two tribes felt they'd been very successful on that.
Well, Larry, you were one of the attorneys, I believe, were you?
No, that's just a mistake. Don't charge me with that any longer. I had nothing to do with it, really. That was Tom Tureen that handled the Penobscot and Passamaquoddy Negotiations and Settlement Act.
Okay, well.